You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the cost of fighting wildfires is rising as the length of the season is getting longer from year to year. An expert tells us why our efforts to control wildfires are being stretched thin in recent decades. Right now, U.S. intelligence has concluded that Russian agents were behind a disinformation campaign meant to stoke divisions on social media in the lead-up to the 2016 election. With midterm elections only months away, some are now questioning whether Wisconsin's voting systems could be the target of digital attacks. Municipal clerks in Wisconsin are confident that the state's voting machines and registration records are safe, but cybersecurity experts warn that they're still vulnerable and that the state can do more to protect them. Grigor Atanasian is a native of St. Petersburg, Russia, and a fellow at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, where he wrote about this issue. Grigor, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we know Russian hackers, Russian officials tried to affect the United States via social media. What do we know, though, back in 2016 and moving into 2018 about Russian efforts to directly interfere with things like voter rolls or voting machines?
So we know that there was an effort to interfere with voter registration systems in a number of states. Wisconsin wasn't one of the states. In Wisconsin, curiously, the Russian actors targeted the servers of the Department of Workforce Development, and we just assume that they got their own address. They've been mistaken.
So as of what we know now, Wisconsin voting machines, Wisconsin voter rolls, things like that, have not, to our knowledge, been successfully hacked at this point, right?
That's correct.
That said, there are concerns about vulnerabilities, and some American hackers took some of our voting machines for a test drive, I guess, and you write about their efforts to find vulnerabilities, hoping that they could be fixed. What did we learn from that?
Last year at DEF CON, which is one of the world's biggest hacker conferences, around 25 pieces of voting equipment, different kinds, all used across the United States. It all was hacked by people with no previous background in voting system, just right there on the ground. And this year there will be more. They staged this voting village once again, and they will be hacking the systems which are particularly used in Wisconsin.
One argument often in Wisconsin is that we're fine. Our voting machines aren't connected to the internet. We have this dispersed system to where you'd have to hack into each precinct individually. What did you find out about that?
Security experts are really not on the same page here. They say that this argument about not being connected to internet, it doesn't make a lot of sense, because 80% of the voting machines used around Wisconsin, those optical scanners, they have little modems in them, which use cellular networks to transmit the unofficial results. So this is one, to say, vulnerability. Also, the diversity, it's a strength, experts say, but it's not enough, because Wisconsin has a lot of close races, and in a close race, you don't need to hack all the systems across the state.
You talked to some county election officials, state election officials. They're concerned, but it sounds like they're not too worried in the scope of things.
Well, on the other hand, I understand why they say that there is nothing to worry, because their goal is to make people confident and for people to get out and vote. They are really, I feel like, concerned about discouraging people from voting, so I understand why they say that.
We're talking about election security here in Wisconsin. Grigor Atanasian is with us talking about a piece he wrote for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Are there fixes? Are there things that experts say, hey, here's one way you could improve the situation and make it safer here in Wisconsin?
There is one practice which is recommended nationally. It's recommended by the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee and the majority of experts on the national level. It's called post-election audits of the election outcomes. It's also called, one specific type of it, it's called risk-limiting audits. It's a statistical protocol. It's really efficient. It's really not burdensome on the clerks, and it's verifying the election outcomes. Even if every piece of equipment is hacked, you will easily find out before you certify the election, before, you know, there is mass. There are some local activists who have been pushing for that for years, like Karen McKim of the Wisconsin Election Integrity. And finally, we hear that the Wisconsin Elections Commission is looking at this measure.
How does that work exactly, risk?
A risk limiting audit.
Yeah, so what, the polls close, the clerks have the results, what do they do?
So you take small sample, a small amount of ballots from across the state, and you verify from what your voting machines say, from what the unofficial result you have, and you see if there are any, you know, weird situations, any irregularities. You verify the number of people voted. You see, look at the ballots. It's a statistical procedure. It's pretty hard to describe into words, but it's been developed specifically by the election officials together with scientists and security experts. So one argument which Wisconsin clerks make, they say it's a great thing, but it's very burdensome on us. We have too many staff to care about. Well, it's not that burdensome, actually.
And you write that a second look at election results in some places has found not hacking, but mistakes where the numbers of votes were not counted properly. Can you talk about those?
Oh, yeah. So Wisconsin was the only state to have a full recount of the 2016 presidential election, and thousands of errors were found, human errors or program errors. They were outdated machines. They were miscounting votes grossly, heavily. There were human errors as well, just votes that weren't written in because of the clerical mistake. And that's normal. I mean, the people have so much stuff to do on the election night, and there is a stress and pressure.
Will these audits catch those problems as well as potential hacking, changing the outcomes of votes?
Yeah. Hacking is just one type of the problem. Hacking doesn't happen as often as human or program error.
We're not far off from a primary election in just 2 weeks and then the big election in November. Is there concern from security officials that Russian agents will try again to gain access to American voting systems?
The top U.S. Security and intelligence officials do say that midterms definitely are under threat, that they are potentially targeted by the Russian intelligence.
Oh, I wanted to ask one more thing. In Wisconsin, for the most part, we have a paper trail people talk about. There is a paper ballot that can be consulted in the event that somebody wants to go back and see what the votes actually were.
That's a strength, having paper ballots. It's used most, I mean, for every vote counted in Wisconsin, you can have a paper trail. So that's awesome. But once again, without the audits, you're not verifying it. You're just hoping that it's correct.
Is there movement in Wisconsin to make these audits happen, or even at the federal level to say, hey, every state, you've got to do these post-ballot audits?
Yes, there is a movement in Wisconsin, which is mostly the result of grassroots efforts of the activists I've already mentioned. And there is a national movement, and actual Representative Mark Pocan is active. He introduced a SAFE Act, which is a measure to secure the future election. And one of elements of it is making this post-election audits a requirement nationally.
We'll leave it there. Grigor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Grigor Atanasian is a fellow at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. He was with us to share his reporting about how Wisconsin's voting systems and their potential vulnerability to foreign hacking. First, wildfire season is well underway, and states like California, Washington, and other western regions of the nation are feeling the impact. So far in 2018, 89 large fires have burned more than 870,000 acres in 13 states, including Alaska. Rising costs and changing weather and climate conditions make it nearly impossible to keep up. Cassandra Mosley is the director of the Institute for a Sustainable Environment at the University of Oregon. She's a former chair of the USDA Forestry Research Advisory Council, which provides advice to the Secretary of Agriculture on forestry research priorities. Cass, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, when we see these drastic wildfires on the TV news and the headlines, it always feels like this is a particularly bad year. In general, are wildfires causing more problems for us than they did in the past?
Yeah, one of the things that's changed since the 1970s, the Forest Service tells us that the wildfire season has grown by 78 days. So people are starting to talk about almost a wildfire year instead of a wildfire season, and that's really changing, not only what we see on TV, but how people experience it on the ground.
A longer wildfire season, is that due in part to climate change?
Yes, scientists attribute that in large part to climate change and climate variability.
I want to take a listen to Cal Fire Battalion Chief Jonathan Cox, who's currently based near Redding, California. He's responding here to a CBS reporter about the frequency of fires in California. This is from earlier today.
Yeah, so, you know, we call this the new normal in California, and we've seen larger and more destructive fires year over year, and unfortunately this year doesn't look to be any different. And we see these surges or these sieges coming through the state. We have 150 additional engines coming in from other states right now, and we put them in places where the priorities are, and we have the ability to draw from National Guard as well. So unfortunately this new normal is kind of upon us in California, more deadly, more destructive fires more often. And it's obviously requiring additional resources, not just from California, but from throughout the United States to get ahead of it.
And let's, Cass, talk about those resources. You've written about those resources being spread really thin as this fire season gets longer and longer.
Yeah, as the fire season gets longer and there's more fires happening at the same time, the federal resources, the state resources, do get spread pretty thin, and particularly late in the season. We see the use of, as the battalion chief was talking about, using the National Guard and things like that. And over time, over the last few decades, we've also seen a real professionalization of the fire operation, both at the Forest Service and agencies like Cal Fire, where people are really increasingly dedicated to this work. And that's through a combination of both the fire getting harder to fight and as well as the Forest Service having many 20,000 fewer employees than it did at the peak of its employment. And so you really have had to, you can't rely on a militia anymore of people who have day jobs as civil culturalists or fisheries biologists being able to sort of drop everything and go fight fire. It's much more of a long season activity.
And this, you had charts in that piece. This is really dominating the Forest Service budget, presumably maybe taking resources from the other stuff that they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, so the Forest Service has seen fire expenditures grow from south of 18% or 15% of the budget now to over half of the budget, with expectations of that number continuing to grow. Although the fire funding fix that was passed as part of the 2018 omnibus appropriations bill will eventually start to take the large fire years out of the Forest Service's budget and hopefully allow them to recover their land management activities and their research activities that have been so core, not only to keeping our nation's forests healthy, but also developing the science and the management needed to protect us from wildfire.
We're talking about wildfires and a longer than ever wildfire season with Cassandra Mosley, director of the Institute for a Sustainable Environment at the University of Oregon. Cass, let's look at some of the other factors in these wildfires. People have pointed toward the way we used to manage forest lands as part of the what's causing problems today. Can you talk about what's led up to this?
Well, around the turn of the last century, we started to think about the possibility of a timber famine, and actually that sense of that a timber famine could come came after the extensive timber harvest in Wisconsin and Minnesota, and as the progressives and created the National Forest Service, the Forest Service, they really were worried about fire destroying timber in the West, and so they started, particularly after the destructive 1910 fires, to suppress fire very aggressively. And over time, that has built up shrubs and small trees in places. And so now, when fires do come, they're more severe, more intense, harder to fight. And so, ironically, fire suppression is a sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. It gets harder and harder each year as the longer fire suppression goes on. It's harder and harder to fight fire.
Yeah, it seems weird, but apparently these wildfires or wildfires used to be just part of the natural cycle of forest lands. Is that right?
That's true. In many landscapes, particularly in the American West, are actually dependent on fire to be healthy. But now that we've had this long history, and plus climate change, plus people living in these landscapes, having fire play its natural role in the ecosystem is very difficult.
One argument I've seen is the idea that more logging in the past, maybe in the present, would help prevent wildfires. Fewer trees, less fuel for wildfires. Is it that simple?
It's not quite that simple. What is really clear is that in some ecosystems, thinning small trees and brush can change fire behavior and change fires from crown fires, that is, fires that are in the top of the fire of the forest, to down to more fire that's on the forest floor, and those are less destructive and sort of more what you would expect in certain ecosystems, particularly ponderosa pine, which is makes up a lot but not all of the West. There are other ecosystems where stand replacing these high-intensity fires have always been a natural part of the system, and logging and thinning in those systems is not likely to make as much difference as in these ponderosa pine systems, where thinning was the very thin open forest was the historic condition.
One point you touched on, I want to dig into a little more. Part of the problem here, part of the cost of wildfires, is because we humans are living in greater concentrations in vulnerable areas. Can you talk about that evolution?
Sure. So, you know, the West is becoming more and more populated, and we love to live where we recreate. We love to live out in the woods. And you know, as more and more people move in, that creates into these high vulnerable areas, that creates it a lot more costly firefighting. But it's also important to point out that Santa Rosa last year, what happened in the Oakland Berkeley Hills 20 years ago, what happened in what's happening now in Redding, those are in suburbs. Those are in places with dense housing. And so for some landscapes, we can't just think of the isolated house in the middle of nowhere as what we're protecting. In some places, these are suburbs or even urban areas where fire can come through. And in those cases, really all you can do is get out of the way, get people and animals out of the way as fast as you can. You know, that's what's been happening in Redding, California over the last few days.
All right. So we have these consequences of past management techniques. We've got people living closer to the forests in larger concentrations, longer, as you say, wildfire seasons because of climate change, plus higher risks of high temperatures and droughts. Are we just doomed? Are we going to just keep seeing bad wildfires again and again?
Well, I think we are fire ecologists in Pacific Northwest will point out that we do have this fire deficit where we can expect more fire to come in the future. But I think there are opportunities here. One is this opportunity in places where it would make a difference to do more thinning for communities. There's been a lot of interesting research about how houses catch fire, and we know for communities having houses that are prepared to withstand fire, communities that have good evacuation plans, have safe routes, and are prepared, it can make a really, really big difference when the fire does come. And so the fire community talks a lot about how we need to learn to live with fire. It isn't going to go away, but communities and households can really have a different experience with fire when it does come if they're prepared, if they've done their thinning, if they've mowed their wood pile, if they've done those things that will make their house more resilient and their communities more resilient.
Can we do that kind of thinning and preventive work on a big enough scale to really make a dent in this?
I think that the key here is to do it strategically. There will never be enough money, but I think what we know is that if you do it around communities in the right landscapes and you really prioritize those strategic acres, that's where you're going to make a difference. And so it's really important to align the incentives and the funding to focus on strategic acres and not just think, you know, more acres just or that we need to treat all acres. We need to be very, very focused in our work.
Who needs to take the lead on those incentives and that prioritizing?
You know, it's really a team sport here. It's, you know, because these are lands that are public lands, they're private lands, they're counties, they're cities, and really no one's off the hook. It's from individual households to communities to public land management agencies to timber landowners. Really, we all need to be working together, and where you see some of the greatest successes in the West at least, have been these places where people have come together and said, you know, we live in a fire-prone landscape. We're going to work together to build agreement and to be very strategic about where we're going to do these thinning activities, where we're going to reintroduce fire, and how we're going to have people be able to get out safely when the fire does come.
In the meantime, do you see any kind of movement to give more resources to fighting these big wildfires, hopefully being able to slow them down, stop them before they spread out of control?
Well, so I think the real key question here is both fighting fire very, very aggressively in the places where when resources are at risk, and when resources are not at risk, when it's in the backcountry, when it's in the wilderness, we might let those fires, you know, get bigger and maybe put less resources to them, so that we have those resources available for the fires that put resources put assets and homes and communities and watersheds at risk.
And so do we have the resources, with that triage in mind, do we have the resources in place when we do need to fight the fire, to fight the fire?
Well, you know, at the end of the season, when it's really, not the end, but at the peak of the season, the agencies are increasingly running out of resources and do have to prioritize. And they're going to prioritize places where those assets are at risk. And that's not a decision that any firefighter or firefighting agency wants to be in, but it does happen.
Cass, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Cassandra Mosley is the director of the Institute for a Sustainable Environment at the University of Oregon. She's a former chair of the USDA Forestry Research Advisory Council. She joined us to talk about the strengths and limitations of wildfire management practices and an ever longer wildfire season. Now, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested primaries for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews here on Central Time and on The Morning Show. You can find all of these interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Today, we start our interviews with candidates for governor. There are contested primaries for both Republicans and Democrats. Today, we start with Wisconsin's current superintendent of public instruction, Tony Evers, who's running in the Democratic primary. Tony Evers, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. A great opportunity here to hear from the people of the state.
Well, if you have the length of an elevator ride to tell someone why you're running for governor of Wisconsin, what do you say?
It's quite simple. And I've always believed this, what's best for our kids in the state is best for our state's economy and best for our democracy. It's the issue that really focuses people on the future, and we have to make sure that future is strong. There's no way that I would have guessed I would have been in this position running for governor, except that I felt the only way I could make that difference is to become governor and move from my position as state superintendent.
And how do you see your experience in that position as superintendent of public instruction as a good background, a good preparation for running for governor?
Well, certainly the issue of state government is complex to begin with. So I've had that experience of running a large agency and actually ultimately responsible for the education of 860,000 kids and 100,000 adults that work with those kids. But that aside, education is one of those issues that connects the dots for people. It plays out in our discussions around natural resources in the state. It plays out in issues around health care and making sure that we have strong mental health services in the state. So I believe that it's a great starting place. This state is looking for change and looking for getting back to being a leader in a number of areas, and that we've really fallen by the wayside. So I'm looking forward to it, and going across the state in my day job as state superintendent has given me an opportunity to learn more about the state and making sure that I represent people correctly, and the same thing's happening as governor.
Now, under Governor Walker, we have unemployment at this super low level in the state. The problem is businesses, in some cases, having trouble finding people to work for them. Are people really looking for change? Why would Wisconsinites want to make a change and flip from a Republican Governor Walker to you or whichever of your opponents in the primary win that race?
Well, certainly that 2.9% looks looks like something that, on the surface, but you don't have to go very far below the surface to see that it's not reflective of a healthy state that's being served economically. We have people that comparing us to lots of other states around us, are working two or three jobs just to frankly get to $15 an hour. We have wages that are stagnant across the state of Wisconsin. Most new jobs are service jobs. Nothing wrong with service jobs. I've done them myself. But the fact is that we need more high-quality, family-supporting jobs in the state. And that's where the crux of it is. As a state, we are not thriving economically. And another reason we have 2.9% is we have fewer people. We have young people leaving the state. And we have, declining birth rate. So all those things factor into it. But the bottom line is I think people are not happy with the economic state of the state of Wisconsin. And we plan to change it. We plan to really focus on those jobs that are really critical to making sure that we have good family-supporting jobs.
So, yeah, if you're governor, what do you do to address that that wage issue, which isn't just a Wisconsin issue, it's a national issue, too?
Absolutely. And the first thing we need to do is raise the minimum wage. I'm a supporter of that, as I believe all the other candidates are also. And that's a starting place. I'm a little reluctant to talk about the minimum wage being the answer to everything because it's not. What we also need to do is make sure that we have good health care in the state of Wisconsin. And, you know, there's a reason that the Affordable Care Act is half the price for the same coverage in Minnesota than it is in Wisconsin. And it's because Scott Walker did not take the Medicaid money. I would do that. He did not set up the exchanges appropriately. I would do that. And we'll have a much better, robust healthcare system if we do those things. And that is a wage issue because it's around take-home pay. The other thing we have to do, and this is a twofer in my opinion, we need to increase our investments in infrastructure in the state, whether it's roads or airports or bridges. And in order to do a better job than being 49th out of 50 states where we reside right now, we would invest in those things, and all the jobs that are around that infrastructure building are good family-supporting jobs. We need to create those things, and also we can emphasize green jobs in the state as other states move towards a more sustainable future. Green jobs are good-paying jobs. Right now, we're training people in the wind industry in our technical colleges, and they're going to Iowa and Illinois in order to get jobs. We need to really focus on things that we believe will be family-supporting jobs.
Talking to State Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Evers. He is running in the Democratic primary for governor, election just a couple weeks off. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Eight people running still in this primary election. How do you distinguish yourself from your seven opponents?
Well, several areas that are quite clear. One is, and the polls are playing out this way, is that I've run three statewide races. And the last time I won, and I'm the only one that has the eight that has won three state races, one was 70% of the vote, and I won 70 of 72 counties. That shows that not only have name recognition, I think people are relatively pleased with the job that I have done and the Department of Public Instruction has done. The other thing too is I've actually run things, whether it's a school or a school district. Now it's a state, large, complex state agency. That means that I will be able to begin my job as governor on day one. There is no assembly required. And the third thing that differentiates me, even though I'm in Madison right now in my job as state superintendent, my wife and I have lived, and my children have lived all across the state, the central part of the state. And whether I began my career in Tomah, I've worked in the Fond du Lac area, in Oshkosh and Appleton area. And I've raised my family there. We've raised our family there. Having name recognition in central Wisconsin is important. 40% of the governor's vote will be coming from that area. I believe that the messages that we're talking about, whether it's natural resources or education, are things that are around Wisconsin values. They're not Democratic values. They're not Republican values. They're values that people in Wisconsin care about. That's why as we look at any Marquette poll, I continue to increase my lead over the Democratic field. They're all great people. I think they're extraordinarily talented people. But the bottom line is I continue to grow that lead, and it's because of the issues that I've done before. I've run things, and also we have a good campaign that's focused on values.
I'm going to get into a couple issues facing the next governor. Foxconn has been a signature project of Governor Walker's current term. A lot of Democrats have been opposed to the incentive package. If you were to be elected governor, what would your approach be to managing that investment?
Yeah, absolutely. And any of the listeners out there to this program right now could have got a better deal than Scott Walker did. It's extraordinarily large and frankly, uncalled for. It's going to hamstring our budget going forward. That said, I believe that it's likely to proceed. I know that there's some hope that it's going to be dashed on day one. I don't believe that's the case. It's part of state law. So what we need to do is renegotiate the things that are out of state law and in the kind of the secret document that we're having trouble seeing. But the bottom line is we need to make sure that environmental protections are in place. We need to make sure that the company has will be providing family-supporting jobs. We also need to, I'll use the Bucks as an example. The Bucks made some real commitments to making sure that minority owners and women business owners, as well as apprentices and workers in those categories, get a fair shot at those jobs, and they've met their benchmarks. There are no benchmarks for Foxconn in this arena, and clearly, if we're going to have this, if we're spending $4 or $5 billion, we should expect that that people that have traditionally not enjoyed the same economic benefit in the state that others have, they get a shot at this, and we need to hold their feet to the fire on those issues. The bottom line is we have to make sure that they are the best corporate citizens possible. Do I think it was a horrible deal? Yes. The bottom line, though, it is likely to continue on, and we need to make sure that the state of Wisconsin has good, achievable goals for that company to make sure that they do the best thing for our people.
We're talking to Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Evers right now, Democratic candidate for governor. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for the candidate? What do you want to know about where he stands on a particular issue? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Tony Evers is with us. We're talking about his campaign in the Democratic primary for governor of Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for Tony Evers? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi, thanks very much. I definitely agree with Mr. Evers that Foxconn was a horrible deal and a terrible giveaway. But why is it that we're always giving enormous tax breaks to corporations who will come back in a year or two and try to extort more money out of the people? Why don't we compete on who has the best education, who has the best trained populace, who has the best quality of life, and the best infrastructure instead?
Tom, thanks for the call. And in addition to Foxconn, we're seeing debate over this idea of a subsidy to keep Kimberly-Clark jobs in Wisconsin. Do you want to address wider issues of subsidized versus quality of life, as Tom was talking about?
Yeah, and Tom is absolutely right. We do need to get to, unfortunately, this is a national issue because states and people within counties and municipalities within states compete against each other, and we're whipsawed. There's no question about that. That's why the issues that are important to me in this campaign are about those quality of life issues. We want to have the best education system. We want to have science actually be used to make decisions around environmental things. We need to make sure that we have the best infrastructure in the country. All those things are quality of life issues, and yes, we do need to compete on that level. Unfortunately, we are also in a position of competing against other states as it relates to this issue of corporate buyouts. or not buyouts, but tax credits. It's critical. I mean, Kimberly Clark's a good example. They've run into a little rough area here, and they're trying to recreate themselves. And do we have good family supporting jobs in that area? Do we need to make sure that they keep them? I believe we do, but we have to begin by investing in those things that the people of Wisconsin believe are important. Higher education. I'm on the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents, and we know, or at least I don't know, I know as a Board of Regents member how important the university system is to economic development. I also know that economic development needs to be more regionalized and localized in the state. Instead of the state deciding we're going to pit Southeast Wisconsin against the rest of the state, we have entrepreneurs that started businesses several years ago that are just waiting to have the state help them out, not with a handout, just helping them out to go to the local bank to get a loan so that they can expand. We need to really personalize and localize economic development in the state. It can't be all around large corporations. That clearly is our heritage, but our future also is about local entrepreneurs, local business people who are making a go at it, creating family-supporting jobs.
I want to jump in and get another caller on now. Joan is with us in Eau Claire. Joan, hi.
Good afternoon. Mr. Evers, I know that you're a fine person, and I think we have many fine candidates for governor now running currently. My question for you is this. Not everyone trusts people that come, trust the candidate that would come out of the Milwaukee-Madison area. Particularly the rural voters and people who don't live in the Madison, Milwaukee area. So do you have a plan for locking in the vote for the rural population and other areas that are not Milwaukee and Wisconsin? That's my concern, because that is a very important voting block and will be in this election. And thank you for allowing me to speak.
Yep, Joan, and thanks for the great question. I am a proud Plymouth progressive. I came from a small cheesemaking town. Met my wife in kindergarten. We had our first date as junior prom. We have lived all across the state, the central part of the state. I get the issues of rural Wisconsin, and also in my day job as state superintendent, I have advocated for rural schools tirelessly. The whole issue of sparsity aid was frankly my creation. The issues around rural schools are and rural towns are intimately intertwined. If a school district loses their small rural school, that town is on its way downhill economically and all other areas. There's lots of studies that show that education is absolutely critical for the cultural well-being of small town Wisconsin as well as educational. I've lived in central and small town Wisconsin. I spent almost all my time campaigning in rural Wisconsin. I have to go back to what I just talked about, Joan, too. We need to regionalize and localize economic development. You know, for example, I know northern Wisconsin has a significant deficit as it relates to health care. Economic development money should be used to maybe create affordable housing so that health care workers can live there. It should be used to help the health industry establish clinics and hospitals in northern Wisconsin. We have to think out of, you know, think new thoughts around how that economic development money can be used for our rural areas of the state. It's critical. I've lived there, and I certainly have spent a lot of time in rural Wisconsin. So I have the chops there, but frankly, we need to do more than just have that. You know, I'll use a small example. I put money in the last budget for mental health care for our schools. Young people in the state, or adults, frankly, in rural Wisconsin, are living as second-class citizens. They cannot afford, they cannot access a human being to serve as a mental health therapist or a physician. The state of Wisconsin has to step to the plate on that. We have to make sure that people in rural Wisconsin are not second-class citizens.
Joan, thanks for the call. We're talking to Tony Evers about his campaign for the Democratic nomination for governor. Katie joins us now in Greene County. Katie, hello.
Hi. Mr. Evers, I'm calling from Greene County, where we have struggled with water issues, coming from mega dairies who want to come in, out-of-state dairies run by kind of unethical operators. And when are when we've tried to regulate locally and have greater restrictions, there have been problems coming at it from the state level. And I'm wondering if you support greater local control to impose tougher restrictions on mega dairies, and if so, what you would do, what would you do to get that?
Yes, and that's a great question, Katie. I just spent a full day in Greene County talking about this issue, both with local officials and also people in the dairy industry and the agriculture area. This is a huge issue. Water is a valuable resource in the state. I would create an independent DNR secretariat, independent board, hire back scientists at the DNR. We need to actually have science be used as a decision making thing. But most importantly, and you hit the nail on the head, that the Republicans used to be the party of local control, and they've flipped it on its head, especially in the area of water and agriculture. People locally need to be part of the decision making. They need to think through culturally how is this mega farm going to impact our area? How is it going to impact our water? Small example: I was just up in Boston a few weeks ago doing an interview, and on the newspaper on the counter talking about nitrates in the soil in northern Juneau County being impacted and on around nitrates. We know where it's coming from. It's coming from a large farm. We need to make sure that the siting of these farms absolutely has to include local input, and I would work with the legislature to change that. Republicans pretty much are part and parcel of this answer. They understand the issue of local control. They gave it up. I will work with them to get it back. I
want to bring on one more caller quickly. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, yes, I guess I have a very specific question that really divided the state here for the past, 8 years or so. But really, it's just a yes or no question. Will you actively look to eliminate Act 10?
Yes.
You will. And are you worried about the impact that could have on school budgets that are they're now in an Act 10 world, just briefly?
Well, there's all sorts of controls over budget besides collective bargaining, and so I'm not worried about that. I think collective bargaining has a place in this state, and I'll actively try to overturn that, but it is going to be tough sledding. So I think we actually need to work on some things that we know can pass a Republican legislature, such as right to work, such as making sure that prevailing wages are paid, making sure that dues deductions happen in a way that works. We need to value collective bargaining, and yes, I fought against it, and I think it has had significant impact around the morale of the people and that work in our schools. I see it every day. We need to change it. Scott Walker came into office saying we're going to divide and conquer, and by God, that's exactly what happened, and we're still paying the price for that.
We'll leave it there. Tony Evers, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's Tony Evers, Superintendent of Public Instruction, running for governor of Wisconsin in the Democratic primary. Attorney Matt Flynn, also running as a Democrat, joins us at this time tomorrow. You can find all these profiles of the Democratic and Republican candidates for governor at WPR.org/governor.